Marketplace is supported by Wix.com, giving millions of business owners the ability to create their own professional website. You can create a website today online at Wix.com.
The great media experiment rolls on. How to wash your car during a mega drought, and the city of Chicago in full-on meltdown mode.
Are we really the worst?
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Zillow, with homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps. Zillow, find your way home. And by RingCentral, the cloud communication system that integrates with CRM, sales and support applications like Salesforce, Zendesk, Box, and now Google for Work. More at RingCentral.com. And by Iowa, offering a business climate with educated professionals and workers in manufacturing, biosciences, and financial services. IowaEconomicDevelopment.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's June 9th, and we are happy to have you here. In the news, not just today, but basically every day, big changes in the economy of media. The latest development is that CNN is going all in on branded content. That's paid-for ads that can look or sound a lot like regular stories. Turner Broadcasting announced a new sponsored content studio called Courageous to create content for CNN and HLN advertisers. And it's just the latest media company trying to figure out how to use sponsored content to raise some cash. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is with us now for more. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Molly.
So we've got CNN. Who else is doing this?
It might be easier to talk about who isn't. The New York Times and Wall Street Journal are selling sponsored content. Condé Nast made news earlier in the year when it announced a plan that would actually have editorial staff working with marketers on making these journalism-like ads. Huffington Post does it. BuzzFeed does it. Forbes actually ran a second magazine cover with content paid for by AT&T. Even public radio is getting in on the native advertising game on digital platforms. So really all over the media industry.
Et tu, Brute? So why are these outlets doing this?
Well, you got to pay the bills somehow, right?
That's what I hear.
I called up Rick Edmonds. He's a media business analyst at the Poynter Institute and asked him that question.
These ads command higher rates, and a lot higher rates, like multiples of what a banner or a more conventional ad would fetch.
Journalism just isn't cheap to produce, and many outlets have been struggling to figure out how to make money. Native advertising, sponsored content, branding content, whatever you call it, looks like a way to do that.
It sounds like you're saying that journalism just isn't free. It's not affordable.
Until they hire robots to replace all of us, then somebody will have to, I guess, pay for the robots. So it's still not free. Sorry.
Robots for hire. How aware do you think are the consumers, the readers and the listeners and the viewers? How aware are they that this is sometimes branded content?
On some sites, it's pretty obvious. Like on Slate today, there was an article called Thinking About a Summer Trip to NOLA, and it was labeled with a bright blue sponsored content on the homepage and the story page. But other times it's a little bit sneakier and harder to see. So much, in fact, that the FTC held a workshop on native advertising, looking at when and how it should be differentiated from more editorial content. And John Oliver took it on his HBO show last week tonight.
I like to think of news and advertising as the separation of guacamole and Twizzlers. Separately, they're good. But if you mix them together, somehow you make both of them really gross.
That is really gross.
It is gross.
But a lot of high-profile sites and companies have signed on, so there must be some upsides, right?
There are upsides. Here's Poynter's Rick Edmonds again.
Well, if you're cynical, you could say it provides work for some people who've lost their jobs at more traditional journalism outlets, because there certainly is a demand for writers who can produce this type of piece.
Editors will also tell you that this sponsored content is still worthwhile content, that they're trying to tell good stories. They just happen to be paid for stories. And again, the biggest upside is that sponsored content pays for independent, high-quality journalism. Long-form, deep-dive investigative reporting isn't cheap. And we're not paying for it. Molly, the old advertising revenue model's not paying for it. So this is a business model that could work as long as news outlets are really transparent about what they're doing and keep their editorial independence.
We shall see. Marketplace's Adrian Hill, thank you so much.
Thanks, Molly.
And speaking of changes in media, if you're a telecommunications company and you haven't been bought or sold lately, just don't get too comfortable. There is a merger frenzy happening in telecom right now. You already know about Time Warner Cable and Charter Communications, Dish and T-Mobile, AT&T and DirecTV. But what about Atlantic Broadband and Metrocast Communications of Connecticut? Anyone? Nobody? Well, it turns out telecom mergers aren't just for the big boys. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn reports on why even the little cable companies are looking to get bigger.
Macquarie analyst Greg McDonald calls it the urge to merge, and it's driving telecom deals, American and European, big and small.
I tell you right off the bat, with the smaller companies, it's the exact same reason why you're seeing consolidation with the larger companies. It's scale.
He says bigger is better for all cable companies because each new household extends the value of, say, a single software investment. The biggest telecoms can also negotiate better deals for pay TV programming like ESPN.
Well, that's the idea.
But smaller mergers don't get that boost. Instead, he thinks Atlantic and Metrocast will try to offset those costs by upselling its 70,000 new customers on TiVo and broadband. SNL Kagan analyst Ian Olgerson says these smaller deals just have smaller benefits.
What they're really looking for is you don't need two accounting departments. You don't need two HR departments and those kinds of fairly straightforward types of operating efficiencies.
But those smaller benefits don't necessarily come with a smaller per-customer price tag, which is one reason law professor Peter Karstensen says the urge to merge is often irrational.
But if everybody else is doing it, then there's this kind of psychological pressure to do it and try to make it work.
There is one way that even the most dubious merger can pay off, if afterwards the bigger company can sell itself for bigger profits to, yes, an even bigger company. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, at least, no major changes. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This past May was, across the United States, the wettest month on record. But down here in dry-as-a-bone Southern California, we hardly saw a drop. The state is still stuck in a drought and has imposed mandatory water cuts. So now the utilities are making the rules. Watering your lawn is out, but getting your car washed, surprisingly, is not. KQED's Lauren Summer has the story.
The most drought-friendly way to wash your car is not to wash it. But Jeff Wheeler is counting on the fact that some people won't be able to stand it.
I'm sure in summer we'll see influx in business, which is great.
Wheeler runs AJ Auto Detailing in San Jose. And just a month ago, the city council here passed drought rules that are a dream for any car washing business. If you live in San Jose, you're no longer allowed to wash your car at home with potable water. Commercial car washes are okay, because most recycle water.
Actually, a customer came in the other day and he brought his truck.
Jeff's brother Jordan says the word is getting out.
He has a big yard and he has like tractors and stuff. And he said that he was washing off a couple of his tractors and a neighbor complained and called the police on him.
Washing your car at home is still allowed by most California water utilities if you have a shutoff nozzle on your hose. But San Jose has banned it with or without a nozzle because the city says it needs to cut water use by 30%. And Jeff Wheeler says his car wash has an added selling point. It's extra water efficient.
How this all starts is there's multiple pumps.
The sudsy water flowing off these cars is recaptured, filtered, and put into large tanks. Each gallon is reused 4 to 5 times, which saves a lot of water.
We're actually only using about 2 to 2.5 gallons per car, and that's less than like a dishwasher uses.
That easily saves as much as 100 gallons over what you might use washing your car at home. But it's nothing compared to what all those green lawns use. So why single out car washing? I asked Heather Cooley of the Pacific Institute, a water think tank in Oakland, and she said some water utilities don't have much of a choice.
As agencies are trying to meet some of the restrictions, in some cases up to 36%, they're going to have to cut a lot of things. And so every bit is going to help.
But other areas, the water thrifty ones, have lower conservation cuts, just 8%. And in those places, the rules are less about saving water and more about getting our attention, like the one where restaurants have to ask customers before they serve water.
It's showing people that we are in a drought, that we need to be thinking about all the different ways we use water.
By making everyday Californians feel the pain, she says, they're more likely to step up and make lasting changes, like putting in drought-friendly landscaping.
In every city, lawns are sort of standard. When a new area is put in, when a street median is put in, and so that has to change. And so this drought, I think, is really going to drive that change.
A change that will pay off by saving water in future droughts, which Cooley says, don't forget, are inevitable. I'm Lauren Sommer from Marketplace.
If today's show has a theme so far, it's about how to react when dramatic change comes your way. If you're a company who's been selling cars for over 100 years, you've seen a lot of that. But now car makers are looking at a future where cars will drive themselves. They need to have internet access. Some people are sharing them instead of buying them, and some cities might not even have room for them. It's a lot to think about. Ford, for one, is building a big research lab in Silicon Valley. I talked to Ford CEO Mark Fields and started with the basics. Does the future have more cars or fewer?
Overall, when we step back, we are in a growth industry. Now, clearly, a lot of that growth is going to come from some of the emerging markets, the Chinas, the Indias of the world. We want to be there for customers. So when we look at the trends around the growth of these mega cities, these 10 million plus cities, there were 10 in 1990. There are 28 today. And in the next 15 years, there could be over 40. So we're looking at that trend. We're looking at the trend of the global middle class. By various studies, it's going to double. What are the first things that people in the middle class want to do? They want to buy a car. In some cases, you'll see car ownership go up in those kind of markets. In other markets, you may see in the urban areas, car ownership could go down. And we're looking at that, and that's why, you know, we're doing these experimentations to say, are there other businesses or other services that we could be able to provide to compensate for that?
Tell us really quickly what some of those experiments are.
The experiments run into three categories around the customer experience, around flexor, what we call usership models, and then social collaboration. And it runs the gamut from ride sharing and car sharing in London to car swapping in the U.S. to parking identification. How do we use the sensors on our vehicles that are on there today as our customers are driving through the city, and they may be able to, those sensors will pick up an open spot, transmit it to the cloud, and then somebody else who's looking for a parking space will say, ooh, there's a parking space on Avenue B. So it runs the gamut.
Is there a point at which this could be a distraction from the core business?
No, absolutely not. This is our message to everyone. And this is the message around thinking not only as a car and truck company, and we're going to stay very, very focused on that, but also thinking as a mobility company. And as any company, you need to have one foot in today and then one foot in the future.
Mm-hmm. And so as you look around with all of these things in mind, who do you see as your competition right now?
Well, our competition overall is, you know, both our traditional competitors,
right,
OEMs, but also new non-traditional competitors.
Those are the ones I'm getting at.
A number of tech companies that have expressed a desire to get into the automotive space. And I think part of it is they're looking at kind of the addressable market. The addressable market in any given year on the car business dwarfs smartphones, dwarfs wearables. And there's a lot of folks that are looking at the auto industry, and that gives us a lot of motivation.
Can I get you to name names? Do you mean Google? Do you consider Uber a competitor?
Yeah, name the names. Google or Uber or Lyft or who knows what Apple's going to do. There's lots of speculation around that. But, you know, many of us are looking at the same trends. We're looking at how customers are using technology, and we're asking ourselves, okay, what does that mean for us as a company? And And how do we want to serve the customer going forward and make sure we have that Ford feel to it, as opposed to becoming the handset business and the receptacle for somebody else's business model?
What's the most far out thing you guys are working on? Like augmented reality windshields, flying cars? Like what's the most far out thing you're willing to tell us about?
Well, the flying cars is not something that's on our agenda these days. But I think, you know, when you look at our whole approach around smart mobility, a lot of our efforts are around connected cars, are around autonomous vehicles.
Did you think ever when you started at Ford that you would start, that you would be talking about cars collecting personal data?
You know, I don't think I can, but when I joined the car business, you know, a long time ago, 25, 26 years ago, to me, I joined this business because it was the world's greatest industrial product in terms of how it came together, the world's greatest consumer product in terms of how it came together. And at the time, there was talk of, would the car ever become a computer on wheels? And that never really materialized. But I always felt that the technology and the lines of code in a vehicle would increase over time. And, you know, now it's getting to the point where it's really exponentially growing, which is very exciting. And, you know, I originally came from the tech industry way, way back. And that's, so to me, it's very exciting.
Thank you for your time.
All right.
Enjoy your stay. I think a little bit of Palo Alto traffic might change your mind about that flying car situation. I'm just saying. Coming up.
I never expected to be recognized, not only just locally, but I mean by the President of the United States.
Building World War II troop transporters to start your career. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average traded flat to slightly lower today to end just 2 points down at 17,764. The NASDAQ gave up 7 points, 0.1%, to close at 5013. The S&P 500 was barely changed, rising less than 1 point to finish at 2080. I believe we call that mixed results. Financials pulled higher today despite news of turmoil at HSBC and Deutsche Bank. Bank of America bumped up 1%. Morgan Stanley lifted 0.1%. Citigroup rose 0.2%. JP Morgan Chase hiked 0.4%. And Wells Fargo jumped 1%. Airlines were mixed today despite being low yesterday after both American and Southwest Airlines released disappointing monthly reports. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note popped up to 2.43%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Arizona State University. With more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, all offered 100% online, with 6 start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. And by MailChimp. More than 8 million businesses around the world use MailChimp for email newsletters, A/B testing, and marketing automation. More at MailChimp.com. And by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to unleash the immune system's power to fight cancer and develop promising new therapies. Videos, white papers, and patient stories are available at discovercarebelieve.org. Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a House Agriculture Committee will discuss the food stamp program. The U.S. Treasury will report the federal budget for the month of May. And on this day in 2007, about 12 million people tuned into the series finale of HBO's multi-award-winning mob family drama, The Sopranos. I'm Daisy Palacios.
You're listening to Marketplace. I am Molly Wood. So there's really no sugarcoating this next story. The city of Chicago is falling apart. Chicago is supposed to pay more than $500 million into its pension plans. Nobody really thinks that can happen. City School District, same situation. It's such a mess that the bond rating agency Moody's downgraded the credit ratings for the entire city to junk status. This is America's third biggest city we're talking about. So now what happens? Chicago native Dan Weissman has been asking around.
I'm from here. I know it's bad, but I needed an out-of-towner's perspective. Todd Ely teaches public finance at the University of Colorado.
As an academic and one who goes to conferences, you know, on exciting things like budgeting and financial management, I mean, whenever the folks from Illinois stand up to talk, everybody kind of looks and says, so tell us what's happening now, right?
So what is happening? I checked with a local, Ralph Martiri. He runs the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability here. Are we really the worst?
Yeah, kind of we are. Our debt per capita is really some of the highest in the nation.
This will sound familiar. We owe our pension plans, like a lot of other places. But more. We skipped payments, a lot of them. We said we'd pay it back eventually, and
this is eventually.
And for Chicago, there's something else. The state constitution. Ours, unlike most, explicitly forbids reneging on pension benefits. The state Supreme Court issued a stern reminder to that effect on May 8th in a ruling which put the kibosh on plans to address the problem by cutting benefits. And that's what triggered the downgrade from Moody's, which itself, just the downgrade, is going to cost us money. Higher interest when we borrow money, maybe some penalties.
We really don't know what the exact fiscal impact will be, but it's not going to be insignificant.
Also, we can't really just cut spending. I mean, yes, you'll find waste and abuse. I could tell you stories, but overall,
you look at the city of Chicago, you know, spending's been cut. State of Illinois, spending has really been cut. We're one of the lowest spending states in the nation across the board, despite having the fifth highest population.
So, spending's already cut to the bone, and we're still in the hole. Here's what that sounds like. Meet some other local experts. Erica Wozniak and her fifth graders at Oriole Park Elementary School on Chicago's Northwest Side.
Who remembers what question we're doing?
Specifically, the kids are discussing how a financial meltdown for Chicago's public schools, they call it CPS, would affect them. Here's one.
If the CPS ever went bankruptcy, it would affect me because the classrooms would be too small to fit the students. And if you ever had a question for the teacher, you wouldn't be able to get to the question because there'd be too many kids in the classroom.
How many kids do we have in our class, Sydney?
36.
There are no desks here. The kids are all crowded around tables. They've each got a crate of books and supplies by their feet. But Ralph Martiri actually has a fix in mind.
Not rocket science, something we call math.
He says it involves politicians putting on their big boy pants and raising revenue, taxes. Economically, this is something Chicago could probably do. William Glaskell watches state and local finance for the Volcker Alliance.
Chicago is a regional, national, and global hub. It's an information-based economy. The financial services industry in Chicago is large and powerful.
In other words, unlike other cities with big problems, like, say, Detroit, Chicago has a tax base. And compared to New York or California, taxes here are relatively low. It's true that compared to neighboring states like Indiana or Kentucky, they're on the high side, but if taxes go up,
are all those financial services firms going to move to Wisconsin?
Probably not. In fact, in terms of its tax base, Chicago could screw itself worse by not raising taxes. That is the view from Todd Ely, remember the academic from Colorado? He says he's been wondering, would entrepreneurs choose Chicago as a place to start a business right now?
Personally, I wouldn't, even though I think it's a great city.
Not because taxes are too high, but because all the chaos, underfunded services, fiscal uncertainty is bad for business.
You know, when do you start having businesses leave, right, that are worried about the quality of the schools?
At least one of the kids at Oriole Park has the same idea.
If CPS goes bankrupt, I'll end up going to a different CPS called California Public Schools.
So that's one family ready to vote with their feet for higher taxes. California is a high-tax state. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Today, we're bringing back our series called My First Job with some help from an editor by the name of Merritt Watts. She has a new book out called First Jobs: True Tales of Bad Bosses, Quirky Coworkers, Big Breaks, and Small Paychecks. And we're interviewing some of the people who told their stories for the book. Today, a woman who found her first job in a shipyard during World War II.
My name is Marion Souze, and my first job was as a draftsman at Shipyard Number 3 during World War II. An art class teacher recommended me for a special course at UC Berkeley. It was a 6-week course in engineering drawing. And when I completed the course, the recruiters from the shipyard came and hired me right out of the classroom. Actually, I was 17 and underage, so I had to kind of fib. We built troop transports while the other yards built cargo ships. It was so busy, there was energy. You could actually see the energy in the air. Everybody with a purpose. Troop transports, you know, took men to war where they were going to serve in dangerous activities. That was kind of sad to know that, you know, that we were providing the transportation for these guys. But we knew that they were going to bring them back, and they did. Yeah, on those ships, on our ships. Mm-hmm. I think I miss the spirit that we had during World War II. Everybody with a common goal to get the war over and bring the guys back. I hate to say it, but during that time, during the 1940s and how I was raised, I just expected to get married and be a homemaker. I never expected to have a career. I'm really proud that I could do something for my country, but I never expected to be recognized. Not only just locally, but I mean by the President of the United States. I never, ever, ever expected that to happen. But it did, and I'm sky high.
Marion Souze, yes, we can confirm that she did meet President Obama a while back when she and a few other women like her were invited to Washington. And yes, we can confirm the president did kiss her on the cheek. Marion lives up in Richmond, California now and volunteers as a docent at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park. This final note today, maybe we've been going about education all wrong. Maybe it's time for some dramatic change. See, it's a thing. A new study shows that kids can learn as much or more from Sesame Street as they do from preschool. The Washington Post reports that kids probably shouldn't just watch Sesame Street instead of going to preschool. But if they do, it's not a total disaster. And the New York Times reporting this week that more and more kindergarten classes are getting back to basics. The basics of sandboxes and dancing and painting time. You know, playing. Proving what parents, good teachers, and children everywhere always understood. All work and no play. Well, you know the rest.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix GoToMeeting. Personalized meeting rooms to help put your best face forward. More at GoToMeeting.com. And by Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle. Farmers Insurance, know the gaps. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, new competency-based certifications designed to make the new workplace work. More at shrmcertification.org.
And that's it. That's Marketplace for the day. Today, the Dow traded flat to slightly lower to end just 2 points down. The Nasdaq gave up 7 points, 0.1%, and the S&P 500 was barely changed, rising less than a point. Caitlin Esch and Vanessa Smith are producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. And the senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Molly Wood, and we'll be back here again tomorrow. This is APM.